Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Well, it's... I don't know if it's global warming. It's just a very warm January in the home of the homeless. But it's a little colder in Baghdad. Iraq announced it will take legal action to ensure justice for the families of the 24 unarmed Iraqi civilians killed in the U.S. raid in Haditha. Yes, I know Fallujah was iconic sound-wise, but Haditha is iconic in terms of the damage done. 24 civilians killed 7 years ago after the one U.S. Marine convicted in the killings, you know, made a deal to escape jail time. Because that's what the Marines do. They make deals. Residents in Haditha, a former Sunni insurgency stronghold of about 85,000 people northwest of Baghdad, expressed outrage at the American military justice system for allowing Staff Sergeant Frank Wouterich to avoid prison. The Haditha incident was a big crime against innocent civilians, said a spokesman for the Iraqi government. We will follow up all legal procedures and judiciary measures to seek justice in the case, he said. He didn't offer specifics. The Iraqi Justice Ministry declined to comment. Marine Corps officials said they do not comment on such statements by foreign governments because Semper Fi, babe. Semper effin' Fi. Ladies and gentlemen, these are your lungs on drugs. Remember your brain on drugs? A couple weeks ago, we were passed on the news that your brain didn't do that badly on marijuana in terms of short-term memory. Now, it turns out smoking low levels of marijuana over decades, who's done that, does not harm lung function, according to a study led by researchers from the University of California, San Francisco. More than 5,000 men and women between the ages of 18 and 30, there's your sample right there, were recruited in 1985 and 86, went to an average of 4 medical exams over 20 years. And they still smoke marijuana. They were asked at each exam about current and past smoking habits for tobacco and marijuana. The volume and force of their breath were measured with spirometry devices. You've got one of those at home, don't you? Next to the hose. As expected, tobacco use was associated with a decline in lung function. Not the case for marijuana use, which was measured in joint ears. That's what I said. It's equivalent to smoking 365 joints or filled pipe bowls. See, that's what I love about science. It's so specific. Within 7 joint years, the equivalent of having a joint a day for 7 years, or one per week over 49 years, there was no evidence that an increase in marijuana exposure negatively affected lung function, according to the authors. They noted that people who were heavier users may have experienced negative effects. Baby. So there you go. Where's Bill Bennett now that we need him? Oh, I know. Eating and playing the slots. Playing the penny slots. This is the new Iraq, faster than anyone expected, barely a month after the U.S. troops left. Iraq's government appears to be coming apart, according to reporters from McClatchy News Service, prompting fears that the country is headed for another round of sectarian strife. This would be the bonus round. Double jeopardy. Prime Minister Maliki, a Shiite Muslim, is driving to consolidate control. This is according to, as I said, to McClatchy, and sideline more secular politicians. In a battle that increasingly appears to be a fight to the finish in which there can be no compromise. Sounds good, doesn't it, to Tea Party members? Bahram Salih, the widely admired prime minister of the autonomous Kurdish region up north, said the infighting is, quote, tearing the country apart. Yeah, mission accomplished. The motto is, I'll have him for lunch before they have me for dinner, he said during an interview. The downhill spiral in Iraq, world headquarters of Mission Accomplished, takes a new turn every week, sometimes daily, responding to a boycott by his Sunni partners in the power-sharing government. Maliki last week locked them out of their jobs, ordering ministries to bar their doors to cabinet officers, even though they still have a parliamentary mandate. A day later, the Iraqiya bloc, headed by Ayad Alawi, used to be prime minister in the old days, he's secular, that has 94 seats in the 325-seat parliament, said that if Maliki did not agree to curbs on his power, he should be replaced either in new elections or by a vote of Maliki's own backers in parliament. Iraqi politics today is a constellation of clashes, many in plain view, others below the surface. It's just one-fifth of the iceberg we're seeing, said an advisor to the prime minister. The more dangerous disputes are still hidden. What was it President Obama said this week? 9 years of our troops being there made us more respected around the world? Well said, sir. Well observed. Hello, welcome to the show.
sun keeps rising in the morning. Yeah, 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 yeah. If you keep on smiling, I'll be running.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer. Welcoming you to this edition of the show, trying to figure out, why if we can store electricity from the sun, we can't store heat from the sun, so that I can soak up the rays here in Santa Monica and draw on them when I arrive in London, where the Siberian Express is supposed to be hitting next week. With frigid temperatures. But that's my problem. Your problem is now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for me to read the trades for you. So copyrighted. Not by me, as it turns out, but from MediaPost.com, consumers view social marketing as invasive. I'll read it for you. Marketers often tout social media as a channel that allows them to reach consumers with messages seamlessly tailored to their interests and social interactions. But nearly two-thirds of people say they hate when a company targets them through their social networking profile. 58% agree that social media marketing is invasive. That's according to a new study. Yeah, they had to study that. At the same time, findings from Insight Strategy Group showed a majority of those surveyed believe social networking sites are the best way to give a company feedback, and that posting about a product or service on a social site can have a strong impact on a brand. Fix those Chevys! In short, people like being able to provide feedback to marketers on social media, but they don't necessarily want to be followed by them. The Insight Strategy study suggests people who have more experience with social networking online are more comfortable interacting with companies. 62% of those who have been using social sites for more than 8 years are following brands. It's a good idea. Compared to 46% of those on social networks for only 3 to 4 years. And 20% using them for less than a year. Overall, more than half of people say they like it when a company has a page or feed on a social marketing site. Incentives help attract consumers. The most common reason for following a brand on social networks is to get special deals. More than half of these responders say Facebook doesn't capture the real me. Almost two-thirds disagree you can learn more about someone online than you can in person. That is in part because people try to project more airbrushed versions of their lives on social networks. The study found 55% share good news on Facebook. Only 26% shared bad news. That compares to 60% of people sharing both good and bad news in person. Not sure what this in-person thing is, but I'm sure it'll be clarified. On a related subject, according to a new study by Utah Valley University, also from MediaPost.com, according to a new study by Utah Valley University sociologists, published in an academic journal called Cyber Psychology, Behavior, and Social Networking, the impact of using Facebook on perception of others' lives is based on a survey of roughly 425 college students. The survey revealed students who spend a lot of time on Facebook are relatively more likely to perceive other people as having better lives than themselves. According to the authors, those who've used Facebook longer agreed that others were happier and agreed less that life is fair. And those spending more time on Facebook each week agreed that more that others were happier and had better lives. Furthermore, those that included more people whom they did not personally know as their Facebook friends agreed more that others had better lives. People who spent less time on Facebook and more time in real socializing with friends tended to be happier than subjects who used Facebook intensively. And just because it's Pledge Week drive time at our home station in Santa Monica, this from Current, the trade publication of Public Broadcasting, Reno's KNPB will end children's programming, actually has already, cutting 2.5 hours from its 9-hour daily schedule of kids' shows, noting the change will put KNPB in third place for the fewest hours of daily children's programming among 30 PBS-affiliated stations in the western United States. Kurt Mischke, KNPB president, said that the changes, quote, will allow us to serve a larger audience of viewers and donors who not only watch, but help to financially support our important service, unquote. KNPB is ending broadcast of the electric company Cyber Chess Super Y One Word World and a daily airing of Arthur. Earlier this year, it cut Fetch. In its place, the station said, will be an expanded schedule of how-to, hobby, and special interest programs, including Antiques Roadshow, Nova, Nature, and This Old House. KNPB is seen by nearly 160,000 people in 71,000 households in central and northern Nevada, northeast California, Mischke said in the press release. We had some days and times where our ratings were not as high as we like, meaning we had the opportunity to better serve our viewers and donors. They also point out that the children who watched the children's programming didn't tend to give money to the station. Please raise your kids to give, won't you? An adjuration motivated by my reading the trades for you. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Gentlemen, news of Nice Corp. Nice people doing nice things. James Murdoch, the media executive at the center of the News of the World phone hacking and police corrupting scandal, is quitting his seat on the board of GlaxoSmithKline, Britain's largest drug company. Their products? Sure, glad you asked. They include Relenza for the Levitra for the Paxil for the guy and Tabloid. A drug called Tabloid, and James Murdoch is on the board of the company. The son of Rupert Murdoch was brought in as a non-executive director and member of the corporate responsibility committee at Glaxo in 2009. He's decided not to seek re-election for the $150,000 a year post. He doesn't need the money. He's got Tabloid. Glaxo insisted there has been no pressure on the media executive to stand down, said the decision had been triggered by Murdoch's decision to relocate to New York. The pharmaceutical company said at the height of the phone hacking scandal last summer, Murdoch was making a strong contribution to the firm, but added it would watch investigations into the issue, which are still ongoing. More about that in a moment. Some questioned 3 years ago why a media man in his 30s who'd spent all his working life inside the family firm should be brought onto the board of a pharmaceutical group. But Sir Chris Gant, the Glaxo chairman, said at the time, Murdoch had useful experience of global business and marketing. And, hey, we make a drug called tabloid. Murdoch's right-hand man in London, Matthew Anderson, is stepping down from his new Nice Corp post. Nice Corp announced that Anderson, the company's director of strategy and corporate affairs in Europe and Asia, is gone as of the end of March. He will return to San Francisco, said the statement, with his family and pursue new opportunities where he might not be arrested. Oh, no, they didn't say that. Rupert, Nice Corp's chairman, described Anderson as a, quote, tenacious and effective executive whose counsel and skills have made a real difference. Unquote. Anderson has been one of James Murdoch's closest advisors. It's been reported that Anderson was supposed to be taken to New York by James and went, no, not that. The editor of the Times of London has said managers at the paper knew as far back as 2009 that one of the reporters had tried to intercept emails in an attempt to reveal the identity of an award-winning blogger. They give awards for blogging? Who knew about that? James Harding said in a letter made public this week that the unnamed reporter told his superiors he'd tried to hack an email account to expose the detective behind the well-known Nightjack blog, which gave readers a behind-the-scenes look at police work. The acknowledgement that senior journalists at the Murdoch-owned publication knew of the hacking is potentially damaging for the venerable Times, one of the world's best-known newspapers. And Rupert Murdoch dropped Christopher Patton's book. He was the British ambassador to Hong Kong in the 90s. His book about his time as Hong Kong governor, to curry favor with the Chinese leadership. That's what Patton, now a lord, told the Leveson Inquiry into Press Tactics and Practices this week. He said the media mogul, Rupert, made a commercial decision to stop his publishing house, HarperCollins, from publishing the memoir because he feared it would damage his efforts to expand his business in China. Murdoch also had dropped BBC's World News Service from his Star Satellite network, allegedly for the same reason. Patton told the hearing plainly, Mr. Murdoch told the View that publishing a book which is critical of the Chinese leadership would not improve his chances, so he instructed HarperCollins to drop the book on the grounds that it was no good. Plainly, there was much evidence to suggest that that wasn't the view of the main editor at HarperCollins. Patton sold rights to his memoir to HarperCollins for about $750,000 advance. He said his editor was so pleased with his first six chapters of the book, he threw a party for him at the Savoy Hotel in London. At about that time, apparently, Mr. Murdoch learned that HarperCollins were going to publish it, and this coincided with his always doomed attempts to extend his empire into China, said Patton. The Inquiry heard that the editor at HarperCollins lost his job for refusing to agree that the book was not good enough. Eventually, Patton secured an apology and a $79,000 payoff. The memoir was published in America with a sticker on the front reading, "The book that Rupert Murdoch refused to publish, adding tens of thousands to sales," according to testimony at the hearing. That's nice. That is nice. News of Nice Corp. The niceness envelops you in nice. It's strange, the things some people say when they're running for president. While the American people worry about their homes and their jobs, some of my opponents have been trying to make an issue, of all things, out of the fact that I may have a Swiss bank account. As part of their attack on the capitalist system, they're trying to make it sound as if that's a bad thing. Well, here are the facts. Millions of people have Swiss bank accounts, many of them Swiss people themselves. If it's good enough for them, I say it's good enough for me.
Mitt Romney, he may not be normal, but he's more normal than the other guys.
I'm Mitt Romney, and I approve this message, although I don't remember doing it. And speaking of the Republican presidential nominating campaign, here's Newt backstage between segments on a cable news interview. I don't think he's going to divorce this one.
Calista. It's like being chopped liver.
Okay, here we go.
There you go. Yeah, hello, Calista.
Yeah.
Did you listen to the first segment?
I was listening. I was sitting down.
Did it sound okay?
Yes. You're doing good. Keep going.
Okay. I just wondered. I was trying to find out what I was doing already.
Just get her some more diamonds, babe. Now, ladies and gentlemen, in the mid-1990s, early in mid-1990s, Newt Gingrich, then just in his early days as Speaker of the House after the Republicans took control of Congress in 1994, he started distributing cassette tapes to Republicans, aspiring Republican politicians, members of Congress, and state representatives around the country. And accompanying those cassettes was this memo from his political action committee called GOPAC. I'm reading from it now. As you know, one of the key points in the GOPAC tapes is that language matters. Language is a key mechanism of control used by a majority party, along with agenda, rules, attitude, and learning. As the tapes have been used at training sessions around the country and mailed to candidates, we have heard a plaintive plea, quote, "I wish I could speak like Newt," unquote. That takes years of practice, but we believe you could have had a significant impact on your campaign and the way you communicate if we help a little. That is why we've created this list of words and phrases. This list is prepared so you might have a directory of words to use in writing literature and mail, in preparing speeches and producing electronic media. The words and phrases are powerful. Read them. Memorize as many as possible, and remember that, like any tool, these words will not help if they're not used. The first list of words are optimistic, positive, governing words. Share, change, opportunity, legacy, challenge, control, truth, moral, courage, reform, prosperity, crusade, movement, children, family, compete, active, we, us, our, candid, humane, pristine, liberty, commitment, principle, unique, duty, precious, premise, caring, tough, listen, learn, help, lead, vision, success, empowerment, citizen, activist, mobilized, conflict, light, dream, freedom, peace, rights, pioneer, proud, building, preserve, flag, children, environment, reform, eliminate, good time in prison, strength, choice, fair, protect, confident, incentive, initiative, common sense, passionate. Often we search for words to define our opponents. Sometimes we're hesitant to use contrast. Remember that creating a difference helps you. These are powerful words that can create a clear and easily understood contrast. Apply these to the opponent, their record, proposals, and their party. Decay, failure, collapsing, crisis, destructive, destroy, sick, pathetic, lie. Unionized bureaucracy. Compassion is not enough. Betray. Shallow. Traitors. Sensationalists. In danger. Coercion. Hypocrisy. Radical. Threaten. Devour. Waste. Corruption. Incompetent. Permissive attitude. Destructive. Impose. Self-serving. Greed. Ideological. Insecure. Flag. Family. Child. Jobs. Anti. Pessimistic. Excuses. Intolerant. Stagnation. Corrupt. Selfish. Insensitive. Status quo. Mandates. Taxes. Shame. Disgrace. Bizarre. Cynicism. Cheat. Steal. Abuse of power. Machine. Bosses. Obsolete. Criminal rights. Red tape. Patronage. No, he hasn't really changed all that much. And he's still reading from his own playbook.
Thinking all day and the day before. But now they're tired, don't want to think no more. They call you sugar, call you pie, say you're pretty, they get you high. That's all right with me. Nothing wrong with feeling good. Nothing wrong with feeling good. Nothing wrong with feeling fine.
This is LeShow on a beautiful weekend in Santa Monica, and surprisingly, showing up here for the first time in the new year. An old and, I don't want to say trusted, but certainly always entertaining friend of the broadcast, Ralph the Talking Computer. Ralph, welcome.
What? Hmm? We're in the headquarters of the movie business, and I'm the one who can't be trusted.
Oh, don't be so touchy. I just meant, you know, there are personal information issues with, you know, some of the stuff on you right now. And
babe, yeah. What do I look like? Mr. Google
here? You don't look like Mr. Google.
I'm not getting in on the Facebook IPO, unlike certain demi-celebrities I could mention.
I am not either, and I am not one. Ralph, anyway, welcome to the show. The approach of this time of year and of your presence tells me that maybe we've got a treat in store. I'm hoping.
It is a treat.
Oh, great.
Harry.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I guess we owe it to the beautiful weather.
How's that?
On a bright, sunny day, apparently the great Larry King was locked in his bathroom for a while, because he's come up with a great new King James column.
Wow.
In the tradition of the great columns he used to write for USA Today.
Indeed, and you used the word great three times in that sentence, so you're really getting into the Larry King delivery. Now, before we get to the reading, do you like these for any particular reason? Do you write them? Is that what...
Oh, no.
Oh.
But I do very much admire the randomizing algorithm at work.
I can understand that.
Anyway, Harry... Mm-hmm. Could we have some randomized music behind me?
You can have it any side of you, Ralph. Ladies and gentlemen, Ralph the Talking Computer, reading King's Things.
These are King's Things. My two cents, I think sadists design underground parking structures. It seems Mark Wahlberg has become a major film star overnight. How does anyone ever beat the Duke basketball team? Peanut butter and jelly is still the best sandwich. I love the pink men's stores. The best all-star game is baseballs. Ever try talking to someone when they're wearing earphones? I know people need reading glasses, but why does my wife need 14? I think Hiroki Kuroda will have a big year for the Yankees this year. I hate it when I have to put in eye drops. The two worst things to lose are your cell phone and the remote control. My wife and I agree on many things, but not the length of our kids' hair. Don't you hate it when people say have a great day? So, have a good day. These are King's Things.
Ralph the Talking Computer, you really got into the kind of the groove of that. You're kind of an 80s computer at heart, aren't you, Ralph?
No.
No?
It's just that on my last update,
yeah.
I got an automatic find the pocket circuit.
Really?
They threw it in for free because I went for the 3-year repair insurance.
Oh, that is such a ripoff. You're never going to use that.
Hey,
yeah.
Que sera. Sarah.
What will be, will be.
What will be,
right.
Will be.
Right, got it. So what do you get an automatic English to Spanish thing the update to?
That's factory. Babe.
Two babes, three greats. Our day is complete. Ralph the Talking Computer, thank you for sharing King's Things with us. And let's just pray that Larry spends the rest of this beautiful weekend outdoors.
Thanks, Harry. That's a big 10-4.
Trapped in the past, Ralph the Talking Computer, here today on the show. We're not number one in the list of press freedom, the Press Freedom Index of 2011. Several European countries fell far behind the rest of the continent. The index has highlighted the divergence of some European countries from the rest. The crackdown on protest after President Lukashenko's re-election caused Belarus, ladies and gentlemen, to fall 14 places to 168th. At a time when it's portraying itself as a regional model, Turkey took a big step backwards, lost 10 places to 148th. Within the European Union, the index reflects this is from Reporters Without Borders. The index reflects a continuation of the very marked distinction between countries such as Finland and the Netherlands that have always had a good evaluation, and countries such as Bulgaria, 80, Greece, 70, and Italy, 61, that failed to address the issue of their media freedom violations, above all because of a lack of political will. South Sudan, a new nation facing many challenges, has entered the index in a respectable position, 111th. Africa saw the biggest falls in the index. Djibouti, a discreet little dictatorship in the Horn of Africa, fell 48 places to 159th. Malawi fell 67 places to 146th because of the totalitarian tendencies of its president, Bingu wa Mutharika. Uganda fell 43 places, and Cote d'Ivoire fell 41 places to 159th because the media were badly hit by the fighting between supporters of rival presidents. One of the biggest failures in Latin America was by Brazil, which plunged 41 places to 99th because of the high level of violence, resulting in the deaths of three journalists and bloggers. Okay, enough about the countries we don't care about. Where does the United States fit on the list of press freedom around the world? Ladies and gentlemen, we are not number one. We are, well, let's say we're right between Taiwan and Argentina. We're number 47. That's exceptionalism with a capital E. And now, news of the Olympic movement. Produced by Jim Ebersol Jr. Scotland Yard says security for the London Olympics has not been compromised after police documents were reportedly found on a train. According to the Sun newspaper, a senior officer left files on a train that detailed plans for policing this summer's Olympic Games. But a Metropolitan Police spokesman insisted the documents were not thought to be operationally sensitive. The dossier reportedly included minutes of meetings where anti-terrorism plans were discussed. It also was said to contain details of pre-Olympics rehearsals, an explanation of emergency lockdown procedures, and plans to avoid traffic congestion. I wouldn't worry about that. The files also contain the names and mobile phone numbers of police officers, according to the newspaper. A commuter reportedly found the documents on a train in Kent earlier this month and handed them to the newspaper before they were later returned to the police. A prominent member of the independent watchdog set up to monitor the sustainability of the London Olympics has resigned in protest at Dow Chemical's sponsorship of the stadium wrap. That is not a comestible. That is the fabric that will be enveloping the stadium. Meredith Alexander, who sits on the Commission for a Sustainable London 2012, has quit her unpaid role over that controversial $15 million deal with Dow, which has angered human rights campaigners because of Dow's links to Union Carbide, the company responsible for the Bhopal disaster in 1984. In a statement, the Commission said it was sorry to confirm the resignation of Commissioner Alexander. It added, Meredith has stated the reason for her resignation is she does not feel she can remain with the commission in light of LOCOG, that's London Committee of the Olympics, appointment of Dow Chemical as a stadium wrap supplier, and the commission fully respects her decision to leave on this basis. We love the respect. From the Daily Mail, all tents and encampments are to be banned from the Olympics, the Home Secretary said this week. Is that it emerged almost 100 people have been arrested ahead of the games. Police and security teams are preparing for all eventualities, and work is continuing behind the scenes to tackle organized criminals. Those arrests include alleged ticket touts, people setting up bogus websites, and those accused of selling bogus hotel rooms. I hope they have bogus beds. A Canadian boxer has her shorts in a knot about wearing a skirt in the ring. Elizabeth Plank, an amateur boxer from Montreal, has come out swinging at a proposal that female boxers wear skirts rather than shorts when women's boxing makes its Olympic debut in London. Forcing women to wear skirts, I think it's sexism, she says. She's received more than 50,000 signatures of support. The ludicrous recommendation clearly has nothing to do with athletics and only serves to enforce gender stereotypes and the subjugation of women, she says on her petition. London 2012 organizers are facing a backlash from prospective parents who have learned they will need tickets for their newborn babies, even if they were not conceived when the highly prized seats were bought. The situation, which has been described as ridiculous and bloody stupid by angry ticket holders, has arisen because most tickets went on sale last April, 15 months before the Games. Ticket holders, some of whom will have babies just weeks old and will be breastfeeding, have been told by the London Organizing Committee they can try to buy an additional ticket for their chosen event for the baby. But with tickets at a premium for many events and only a few pay-your-age concessionary tickets available, most parents will not be able to get a ticket or will have to pay the full price. Everyone attending the Olympic Games must be a ticket holder, no matter how old they are, one parent was told. The policy has drawn a furious response from parents on the Mumsnet website in recent weeks. London 2012 organizers say the policy has been clear from the start of the ticket sale process, and it is not unusual for sporting venues. The process has been hit by a number of controversies, most recently when organizers were forced to close the ticket resale website for a week after technical problems. But in face of the complaints, LOCOG said this week, midweek, it was shifting, perhaps, its position and said would reevaluate the situation, but stop short of promising tickets for newborns. The Olympics. It's a movement. And we all need one. Every day. Ladies and gentlemen, apropos of social media, which we talked about earlier in this broadcast, did you know that Kim Kardashian, I'm assuming you know who that is, gets paid $10,000 for tweeting an endorsement of a product? Recent endorsements have been for ShoeDazzle.com and CVS, the large drugstore chain. The biggest player in the pay-for-tweet market, reports New York Magazine, is Adly, a social media advertorial clearinghouse pairing brands with celebrities to inject highly personalized advertising into their Twitter streams. Pay rate is, of course, determined by the size of a celebrity's following and how that group responds to his or her tweets with shares and retweets. So Snoop Dogg, with 6.3 million followers, that's what's wrong with this country, is in the top tier of payments, $8,000 per tweet. Paula Abdul, 2.5 million followers, gets $5,000 apiece. Charlie Sheen was paid about $50,000 per tweet. It was worth it. His tweet for internships.com generated 95,000 clicks in the first hour. Social media, ladies and gentlemen. Of course, Charlie didn't write those tweets himself. No celebrity does. Instead, they're composed by hungry young tweet ghostwriters. There's a job they didn't tell you about at Career Day, whose job it is to broadcast a celebrity's voice in 140 characters, says Adly CEO Arne Gulov Singh. Quote, consumers react positively to organic, authentic messaging, unquote. Especially when it's written by somebody else. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the atom.
Save to cheap to meet. Save cheap to cheap to meet. Cheap save to save to meet. Save save to save to meet.
Addie didn't make it. Addie the Atom didn't make it here today. He's sunning himself on the beach. A governmental panel appointed by Energy Secretary Stephen Chu released a report this week taking the United States' lackadaisical attitude regarding nuclear waste disposal to task. Quote, "Put simply, this nation's failure to come to grips with the nuclear waste issue has already proved damaging and costly," wrote the panel. "The problem is diverse and robust. Rather than store all nuclear waste in a single highly protected location, the current U.S. policy bides time by housing the radioactive byproducts of nuclear fission at each of the country's 104 operating plants. The system has holes." A Newsweek report a couple of years ago highlighted security lapses at some nuclear plants. 8% of plants holding high-level nuclear waste failed security tests. But wait, there's more. The operator of Japan's crippled nuclear power plant will be effectively nationalized for at least 10 years under a plan to provide it with enough money to fund compensation payouts. The funding from a public body is expected to inject $13 billion into TEPCO, effectively putting it under state control. The scheme is expected to be included in a comprehensive business plan to be finalized in March. Under the plan, TEPCO will remain listed on the Tokyo Stock Exchange. The funding body will receive money from special government bonds and contributions from other utilities which have nuclear power plants in Japan. The business plan is aimed at preventing TEPCO from becoming insolvent due to the heavy costs stemming from the world's worst nuclear accident since Chernobyl. But it's cheap. It is cheap. It's just Deadline Oak Ridge, Tennessee, the government's security contractor confirmed this week it is investigating allegations that a security officer slept on the job and also used an unauthorized cell phone inside a high security facility at Oak Ridge National Laboratory. They've instituted an investigation into all the allegations, said spokeswoman Courtney Henry. Photographs of the individual in question were distributed anonymously to multiple groups, including the News Sentinel in Tennessee and the U.S. Department of Energy. The photographs were taken reportedly inside the highest security facility at Oak Ridge. The building houses a large stockpile of fissionable uranium-233, which could potentially be used in an atomic bomb. Henry would not confirm the identity of the individual or whether the photographs were taken inside that building. And Japan's energy minister admitted this week no records were kept of top-level discussions in the critical early days on how to respond to the world's worst nuclear disaster in 25 years. The admission and apology by Trade Minister Yukio Edano comes in the face of widespread debate over the government's response to the Fuk crisis. Quote, "It is inconceivable that there were no records kept. It may have been difficult to keep official logs during the extreme confusion after the crisis, but they could have taken simple memos," unquote. Kenji Sumita, an emeritus professor at Osaka University who specializes in nuclear engineering. "Perhaps," he said, "there were some goings-on that the participants did not feel comfortable going public. It's clean, it's cheap, it's safe. It's too safe to go public. Our friend the Atom." And now, just before we close today's broadcast,
Super Bowl. We can't sweep your butt beneath the rug. You're screwing up all kinds of drug.
News of superbugs, ladies and gentlemen. Land and marine iguanas and giant tortoises living close to human settlements or tourist sites in the Galapagos Islands are more likely to harbor antibiotic-resistant bacteria than those living in more remote sites on the islands, researchers say in a new study. Feces, pardon me, collected at several different sites from free-living reptiles harbored E. coli bacteria that were resistant to ampicillin, doxycycline, tetracycline, and one more, another bacterial species collected from the species, from the feces of the species, Salmonella enterica, was found to be only mildly resistant. The studies are reported in the Journal of Wildlife Diseases. This is not the first study to find that wild animals living near humans or affected by tourism can obtain antibiotic-resistant bacteria from that exposure, said the leader of the study. So stay home, won't you? Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.490 megahertz shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin. Around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it. HarryShearer.com and KCRW.com. Available through your smartphone via Stitcher.com and available via podcast free. No charge. You don't got to pay the man no money at KCRW.com. And it would be just like using the words pathetic and bizarre every day if you agree to join with me then, would you already? Thank you very much, A tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. This broadcast is on Twitter. Join the almost 55,000 followers. I know it's 1/100th of Snoop Dogg's followers, but they don't pay me to tweet at The Harry Shearer. Maybe if more of you followed, they would pay me. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.